Lights on. Green lights on. Is that good? You hear me? All right. Great crowd. Wow. What a turnout. What else could you be doing on a Friday night? Probably a lot of things, right? Well, guys, where are you going to go to a place where you find this many girls in one spot? Right? And a place where they've come for a good reason. You won't find probably a better gathering anywhere close. I'll tell you a story. When I was your age, I would go to gospel meetings. One, to hear the greedy meetings, but the other reason was to meet girls. And one night, I'll tell you this story real quickly. I was at a meeting and I spied a young lady during the service. And I managed to keep one eye on her and one eye on the speaker most of that evening. And after the service, several of us guys were talking. And I don't know how I lost track of her, but anyway, we were talking, gabbing. Well, out of the back corner of my eye, or out of my vision, the young lady that I had spied walked straight up to me and introduced herself. And for the first time in my life, I was completely speechless. The guy was standing there talking to me. He said, "Scott, your mouth went..." I think I almost fainted. So guys, if that happens tonight, don't faint. Keep your mouth together. Get a few words out. Anyway. We're going to be talking about Jesus as a man under authority. I enjoyed Steve's comments. I thought they were very well organized, very well delivered. Kind of hate to follow Steve because he does such a good job. Some of the things I will talk about tonight will echo some of the things that he mentioned. But we're going to look at Jesus specifically. For the most part, I did find a little video that I think illustrates authority. We're going to look at that. It really is going to show our concepts of authority. And give it just a second here. I want you to watch. Here's a guy holding up a sign saying, "Honk twice." Just hold that thought for a second. Why do you think he had no more success than he did? Huh? Okay, he's a teenager. He's holding a sign up, probably from a group of adults. Wasn't a very good sign either, was it? Not something they normally do. Okay, they probably approached that intersection many times and had not seen that before. Let's watch this one. A little better results, wasn't it? And why do you think that was the case? Huh? Okay, he looked like he was in a position of authority. He looked the part, didn't he? He was an older gentleman. Well, not that old. But he had on a suit and a tie and looked like he was a security guard. Looked like he probably had the authority to tell him what they needed to be doing, right? Let's watch one more little part of it. Let's show you there's one in every crowd. There's a jerk in every crowd. Watch this. All right. So I hope you kind of got the point of that. Now that's not going to really be a lot. That's not going to be a major part of our lesson. We're going to really focus on Jesus. But the points I really want you to understand is our society, our culture, and every society and culture is built around the need for authority. How would we accomplish anything if we did not have a system or rule of authority? How do you think this building got built? It just didn't fall together in places. There had to be an organized system, an organized approach. Someone had to tell people what to do. Somebody had to be in charge of it. And you're going to find that aspect is true in every part of your life. Every facet of your life is going to have some aspect in which there will be an element of authority associated with it. So I hope that video kind of helped you see that. But we want to look at Jesus tonight. I got to point backwards, right? Now, if you listen to a lot of liberal theologians, people in the world who like to really have another agenda when they talk about Jesus, a lot of them will want to portray Jesus as a radical, one who sought an upheaval of Jewish leadership and maybe even Roman leadership. He was anti-establishment, it said. He was a rebel. I've read that said about Jesus. I don't think anything could be farther from the truth. I do think we should acknowledge the fact that Jesus did seek to stop the abuses and the things that were going on that were wrong from the Jewish authorities. Remember, there were things that the Jewish leaders at the time were imposing, laws they had made, traditions they had established, that became absolute laws. And if you did not follow them, in their minds, you were sinning, when God had said nothing about it. Jesus did seek to stop that. But I think as we'll see tonight, Jesus, in many aspects of His life, and we're going to look at three principles tonight, Jesus did follow authority. And Jesus is our ultimate example, isn't He not? Jesus clearly respected authority. And I'm going to look at three areas tonight. And Steve's alluded to these already. In fact, Steve's alluded to these all of these already, and you'll hear more about them as we continue over the next day or so, over the next day. Submission to the authority of these earthly parents. We're going to look at some examples of that. Submission to civil authorities. And then lastly, submission to the authority of God, which really encompasses all the others. We're not told a great deal about Jesus' early life, are we? What are we told about his first, let's say his childhood? What's the first thing we learn about? What's the first thing that happens to you when you enter life? You are born. You were born. If you're going to write your biography, you're probably going to start, "I was born." I think David Copperfield starts it that way, I think. "I was born." Well, we learn about his birth. We learn about some things that happened with it. What's the next thing that we learn? Don't be afraid to be wrong. Huh? Okay, he did grow up, right? Age 12. What did he do at age 12? What did we learn about him at age 12? Okay, Trenton kind of got ahead there. Exactly. That's exactly what he did. He spoke to the doctors and lawyers of the law, but he had gone there for what reason? Yeah, he'd gone to there with his family, the Passover feast in Jerusalem. I have read from some secular authorities have cited that when the Jewish Passovers were celebrated in Jerusalem during that day, guess how many people it's estimated were in the city of Jerusalem? Anybody got a guess? 50? Does that sound a little low? 1,000? Got to keep going. Keep going. Let me just tell you. 2 to 3 million. I have read that there was as many as 2 to 3 million people in Jerusalem during the Passover celebrations of that day. And that'd be a pretty big event, wouldn't it? Let's say you're going, and you're probably going to see people you haven't seen in a while. And you can imagine your entire lead up just to go into this. You're going to anticipate this pretty well, I would think. You might see people you only see once per year. And there would have to be accommodations made. You know, we had to make accommodations for some of you to stay tonight. This was, we only got a crowd of maybe 150 or so. Can you imagine trying to accommodate 2 million people? Well, they had gone to that celebration, and they were on their way back. Now, culture was a little different back then, was it not? Usually when you go somewhere, you go to Huntsville, most of the time, your parents are going to kind of want to know where you are and how are you going to get back. Well, they made the assumption, his parents did, that, well, what assumption did they make? I mean, we're in Luke 2. What did they think had happened with him? They were on their way back, and he wasn't with them. And what did they think? Okay, he had come with some friends or acquaintances on the way back with the caravan. You remember, they would not have been the only person from Nazareth to go to the Passover, would they not? He would probably have friends and acquaintances from Nazareth that had gone there, and they were all on their way back, and they just assumed he was with them. And that evening, they began to look for him. They could not find him. And you can kind of imagine the panic that kind of fell on them at that point. I would imagine panic or worry or concern. And they began looking with them, and they wound up going all the way back to Jerusalem. And where did they find him, Trenton? In the temple, since he had kind of said that already. Yeah, they found him in the temple doing what? Okay, he was having a religious discussion with the teachers of the law. They were listening to him, and he was listening to them. Question and answer kind of thing. And they were amazed at him. Let me show you something else that I didn't point out. Luke 2 and verse 40. The Bible makes a comment about Jesus that he is growing. As he continues to grow up, as Hannah mentioned a few minutes ago, it says that he was increasing in wisdom and the grace of God was upon him. So this is a special young man. We know that already. But even those who didn't know anything about him otherwise, I think could have quickly perceived there's something different about him. There's something good, about him. And they were astonished. The teachers were just listening to him, asking him questions. They were amazed at his answers and his understanding. And his father and mother found him 3 days later. And they were astonished. And they said, "Son, why have you treated us this way? Why have you done this to us?" And I don't believe that is inferred that he did anything wrong necessarily. But it's just showing their level of concern for him. And he responds to them and says, "Why did you seek me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" He had a duty to do. He had something that he had in mind that he had to do. He knew who he was. Now, he's not ready to start his public ministry. That'll come 18 years later or so. But even then, Jesus recognized that he had a responsibility to do God's will. And some of you, most of you are older, I guess, than 12, but you're old enough to realize that. He certainly did at that age. What else does it say? Verse 51. He went down with them and was subject to them. Why did they say Jerusalem was up on a hill, wasn't it? Something, a mountainous area. And when you went from Jerusalem, you usually went down. So that's why it says it that way. He was subject to them. He recognized their right to expect him to obey them. You see that? And the Bible makes that point for us. And I don't think that's an accident either. The Bible, God wants us to know, God wants us to understand that Jesus obeyed his parents. They didn't really understand why he said what he said, but his mother, she treasured these things in her heart. That's something that you can think about probably as time went on and when he became apparent as to who he was. You know, I think these things may have made more sense to her later on. So Jesus clearly respected the authority of his parents. Let's look at another example. In fact, the Bible makes us another point here in verse 52. Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. He kept on increasing, kept growing. We don't know anything about the next 18 years of his life. And that's amazing to think about. He grew up as a Jewish boy in a family that eventually later on had brothers and sisters And he would have been dealing with some of the same things you do. Yes, the culture was different, and yes, the time was different. But there are still things that people had in common back then as they do today. And he lived with his family. He was told what to do. It's said that most Jewish boys would have learned to read and write in their own homes. Their home life would have consisted of theirs, and particularly, he learned how to be a carpenter, did he not? He learned how to work with wood, learned how to build things. He learned that from his father. And he grew up. And the next thing we know of him, he's about 30 years old. And you think about all that life and all that span of 18 years of time that he lived. And think about that he lived without ever sinning. It's just an incredible thought to think about. But he did. All right, let's look at another example of him expecting his parents' story. This one may be a little harder to draw out, but I think you'll see the point. John 2 is where I'm going. Now, they went to a wedding. Yes, people got married and they had weddings and they had celebrations back then just like they do now. And he had gone to this wedding with his family. And his mother comes up to him and the party ran out of wine. And I'm going to briefly stop here because this is not about this, but I don't want you to get confused. When you see the word wine in the New Testament, you need to understand the majority of the cases, maybe all of the cases, and I know without a doubt in this case, the word wine is a very broad term. Okay, it can include highly fermented or alcoholic wine, or it can include grape juice. And the context of the passage usually will help you see what's being talked about here. So don't let anybody confuse you and say, well, Jesus turned water to wine. Why don't you drink? Don't let anybody confuse you with that. Recognize that that Greek word can mean grape juice. Okay, so anyway, whatever that's worth. So Jesus' mother mentions to him that they have run out of wine. And Jesus responds to her, woman, what does that have to do with us? Now, does that sound harsh? Do you call your mother woman? Do you expect to call your wife woman one day? Try that one. The term in English does not translate the same way. I'm told and read, that it was really a quite polite term, and there's really not a good term in English for us to translate it to, for us to really understand the real connotation of it. That's really the best word in English that can be chosen. So don't assume that he was being rude to her, because he was not. He was being very polite to her. But he mentions that it's really not time. He says, my hour's not come. And she mentions this to him. I think the fact that she mentions it to him seems to imply that Mary thought Jesus had the power to alleviate the shortage. Okay? And I mentioned, Jesus' response may sound harsh, but in reality it is not. In the original language, it is not. Look what Mary says. Whatever he tells you to do, you do it. So what did he tell them to do? Right there in your Bibles. Somebody that hadn't spoke up yet. I know you know the answer. It's Friday night. I know you're not this bashful. It's Sunday morning. I would expect this. What did they do? Filled up pots, big pots of water. 6 big pots, I believe it is. And when they went to dip, it had been changed. And again, the context here, and we're not going to talk about the miracle itself, the context here indicates this would have been grape juice. It would have had a good taste. And the bridegroom recognizes that. This was the beginning of the signs Jesus did at Cana of Galilee and manifested His glory, and His disciples believed with Him. And He went down from Capernaum, He and His mother and His disciples, and they stayed there a few days. Jesus seems to have wanted to please His mother. He did this out of respect to His mother. He did not do that necessarily just for that reason, but look at what the response to that miracle was. His disciples believed in Him. It produced belief. I think you'll see in every case of the Bible, a miracle would have produced belief. And that's what I believe that was the real purpose that He did it. But He seems to have had a concern for her, of what she was wondering, of what she was needing at that time. Let's look at another example. Jesus is upon the cross. I'm going now to John, the 19th chapter. Jesus is dying now. I want you to put yourself in that position just for a moment. Can you imagine being a criminal sentenced to death and the day has come and it's happening? Imagine your heart would be racing. And think about the fact that Jesus had never even done anything wrong. Never had done nothing to deserve this. But He is willingly giving Himself as a sacrifice for us. I don't think the people there that were doing that understood that. But He looks and sees His mother. Verse 26. And the disciple whom He loved, standing nearby, He had one disciple that He was close, very close to. And He said to His mother, "Woman, behold your son." And there's that term again, a very polite term. And He said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." He was concerned about her well-being. What did that disciple do from that very hour? Yeah, took her into his own home. And implies that he took care of her, right? He had a concern for her, even at the, and he's lying, he's dying, he's already been scourged, beaten, and he's nailed to this cross. You could barely breathe. And I'm not going to go into all the details about what was involved in crucifixion. I think most of you have some awareness of that. I mean, but he is concerned about his mother at that time. Again, Jesus clearly respected his mother. He respected his parents. He wanted to make sure that she was taken care of. And the implication here is that his father probably at this point had already died. We don't read anything about him after a certain point. He clearly showed respect and concern for his parents. And Jesus is our ultimate example with respect to that, is He not? Let's look at another example. Well, let's say a couple more things with respect to this. Jesus would have been aware of the Old Testament passages regarding honoring father and mother. What was the fifth commandment? Of the Ten Commandments, remember there was ten? Honor father and mother. Right? He would have been aware of that. Consider Exodus, the 20th chapter, verse 12. I just quoted that. Chapter 21, I want to ask you to turn to all of these. There were rules involved with a stubborn or rebellious son. If a son was rebellious, would not listen to his parents, the penalty for that was death. You think punishment's bad now, try death. You think most people kind of got the point that God expected you to respect your parents back then? You think a lot of people had trouble with that? I don't know, but I would imagine if you knew that penalty was looming, you probably would take that one pretty serious, wouldn't you? Proverbs 30 and verse 17, "The eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out, the young eagles will eat it." I think I just quoted Deuteronomy 21 instead of Exodus 21, but Deuteronomy 21 has a few more details with respect to the stoning and the things that are said, and the elders of the city and their involvement. The men of the city actually took the man out and stoned him as a result of that. Serious business, wasn't it? And Jesus would have understood that. It's also part of the New Testament law. Ephesians 6 and verse 1. I know you've heard that one all your life, most of you. And there's connection with it. There's a promise connected with that. What is that promise connected with it? Somebody mumbled it. I can't hear you. Yeah, that you may live long upon the earth. Right. Jesus was the ultimate example of this, right? All right, let's look at another aspect of this. Jesus recognized civil authorities. Matthew 22 is where I'm going now. Let me ask you this question, those of you who might know. Who were the ruling authorities of this time period in Judea and in the area where the Jews lived? Romans. Okay, the Romans, a few decades before, had invaded. The Roman Empire was in place. Of course, the Bible shows quite clearly that when Christ came, when Christ was to come, that the Romans would be in charge, that fourth world kingdom would be in charge. And of course, the Roman Empire is in place now. And the Romans could be quite ruthless, but for the most part, they tended to allow, they allowed people like the Jews to practice their own religion, to maintain a lot of their customs. But there was something that they demanded, and they demanded taxes. And they demanded a lot of taxes. I've read some estimates of what they would have extracted from one region, and it was a considerable amount of money. And there had to be a means for gathering those taxes. So let's say you're a Jew and you understood the Old Testament law and you knew that God had given you this land, and here these Romans have come in and taken this land over. How are you probably going to feel about that? Think you're going to like it? What about when you have to pull that pocketbook out? I don't know if they had pocketbooks, but wallets, but maybe they had one in their robe somewhere. I don't know. That was not going to be a good feeling. You had to pay those taxes, would it? And even the people who collected those taxes, what were they? How were they viewed? Those publicans. They didn't like them. Here comes this guy coming to get my money. A lot of those guys were corrupt. That was another reason they didn't like them. So this was a considerable debate among the Jews. Do we have an obligation to pay taxes to Caesar? Now Jesus, in this context, had already dealt, had really addressed the Pharisees and Sadducees pretty well. So the Pharisees plot to entangle Jesus. They're going to come up with this question. It's one of those questions there. It's kind of like the question of have you stopped beating your wife? You ever heard that question? How are you going to answer that? Oh yeah, I quit. I've never done that. Or yeah, no, I haven't quit. I mean, it's one of those, either way you answer it, it's not going to turn out good, right? So they ask him this question, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? And they plot with these Herodians. Herodians, it's assumed, had some allegiance to the Herod family, which would have meant allegiance to the Romans, right? So they plot with these Herodians and some of their young other disciples. They send with them quietly, and they're going to hit Jesus up with this question. And they think, depending on how he answers, he's going to make somebody mad. So they ask him, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? Well, what does Jesus do? Okay, ask for a coin. And what did he do with that coin? Yeah, who's on this coin? Who's the inscription? Whose likeness is it? And what do they say? Caesar's. And Jesus makes the point, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. What he's saying here is that he is recognizing the right to exist of the Roman authority. They were the ones who backed the money. They were the ones who controlled the medium of exchange that was used at that time. It was it was their money, in a sense. And he had a right to demand taxation upon it. And when he made that argument, it really put to silence anybody that had a question about it. I mean, the Romans certainly couldn't say anything wrong with it. But he gave justification. This really belongs to Caesar. And it really recognized the Roman government's authority to exist. God places into authority governments. What would we be like without government? Huh? Yeah, well, it'd be unorthodox, wouldn't it? I mean, what if there was no law about anything? What if there were no regulations upon anything? What if there was nobody gathering taxes? Would you have schools to go to, for the most part? Would you have roads? Be chaos. Would there be anybody to curtail violence? Could you call the police and say, hey, somebody's trying to break in here? No, you probably wouldn't have that, would you? God authorizes this. God brings them into power, and Jesus is recognizing that here. Okay? He also taught that, again, in connection with this, John 19, when he is being tried, Pilate says to him, basically, he's actually trying him, and he gives him an opportunity to speak, and Jesus is keeping silent, and that would have been in accordance with prophecy. He said, "Don't you know I have power to crucify you and power to release you?" And Jesus says, "You would have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you," I think speaking of the high priest, Caiaphas, "has the greater sin. You would have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above." Jesus recognized that God places civil authorities. And I think that's something that all of us have to learn. All of us have to learn that and respect that. And you're going to hear some more about that later on in our studies. I realize that I don't want to touch too much on other people's points. Steve's alluded to it. I'm alluding to it. And I think some others will even allude to it even more in more detail. One thing we never see Jesus doing, we never see Jesus leading an insurrection against the government. And there's nothing in the Bible involved that suggests that we should. And going along with what Steve said earlier, unless they cause us to violate God's law, there's nothing that says we should ignore civil laws, even if we don't like them. Do you like the 70-mile speed limit on the interstate? Can any of you remember when it was 55? None of you remember that? When I was your age, the speed limit was 55. Interstate everywhere. Did y'all know that? Nobody knew that? Not counting some of you in the back. Yeah, it was 55. They thought it'd be a good idea to make it 55 so we'd save gasoline. We got in this big gas crisis back in the 70s, and I guess gas hit a dollar and something, and everybody went to pieces over that. Now it's $3.20, and we're driving the car. Our parking lot here at Eastside's more filled than it's ever been, which is a good thing in one sense. Yeah. Now, are we expected to follow the civil laws? Does God expect us to do it? He does. We may not like them, but God has an expectation, and they are. The rulers, the powers that be are here for our benefit, right? And no, you can't speed because you're going to be late for church. That doesn't justify it, okay? The biggest point I want to make in terms of Jesus, everything Jesus did was in submission to the authority of His Father. We're going to look at some verses now. And you don't have to turn to those necessarily. I'll read some of them. Oh, you can turn to them. John 5 and verse 30, "I can do nothing of my own initiative. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of Him who sent me." John 6, just probably a page or so over in your Bibles. "For I come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of Him who sent me. This is the will of the Father who sent me, that all He has given of me I should lose nothing, that I should raise it up at the last day." John 12. "The things that Jesus spoke were not of His own authority, but of God. The Father gave me a command," He says in verse 49, "what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that His command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak." He is doing God's will. He is speaking the things God says. I want you to think about the fact that Jesus willingly left heaven come to earth. Turn over to Philippians 2. I would like for you to look at that one. Philippians 2 and verse 5. "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made Himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant, and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, He humbled Himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross." Jesus was and is God. And He came to live here as a man. He still retained His deity. But He lived here on earth as a human being. Hebrews 10. Verse 5, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you have prepared for me, and burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you had no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come, in the volume of the book is written of me, to do your will, O God. God, Jesus came to do God's will. And let's just think about something that He did. Turn over to Luke, the 22nd chapter. We talked about the crucifixion a minute ago. You think that was easy? No. Verse 42. Really, verse 41. He had his disciples with him, I believe, and he kind of goes about a stone's throw, about as far as you can throw a stone, and goes away. He kneels down and pray. And what does he ask? I'm looking at verse 42. What does he ask God? If it is your will, take this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And it says an angel came to him from heaven, strengthening him. And even after being strengthened, and I didn't notice this until studying it this time, the angel actually came and strengthened him, and then even after that, being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. You think about it. They're coming, and you're going to be dead very soon, within hours. I mean, is your heart going to be racing? Can you understand why he would be sweating the way that he is? I can kind of see that. It's just like a man being condemned today. You ever think about, I'll be honest with you, I feel sorry for people who are executed. I know they deserve it. The ones that, I guess for the most part, all deserve it. Because they've done things that that require a penalty for death. Of death. But I can't help but feel sorry for them. How they got there. How they got to that point in life. Can you imagine what those people think about the night before they go to the gas chamber, or to the electric chair, or to the most usually by lethal injection nowadays. When I was your age, it was the electric chair. You imagine the things going through your mind if you're in that situation. He is going through that to some degree. He knows what's coming, and he is in agony over it, and he is sweating like great drops of blood. Sweating profusely over it. I think I can kind of see why he feels that way. But his overriding desire was to serve God. Even to the point of death. Even to go through that. He was willing to do it. His mind was made up. He was going to do it because God, that was God's will. And he was willing to do it, and he did it. And he is our ultimate example of submitting to authority. I want you to think about, just a moment, what God demands of us, what God expects of us. We have to deny ourselves, don't we? We have to make our will God's will. Our goals, our aims, our aspirations have to be brought to be what are in keeping with God's. Right? Now, that doesn't mean you can't have aspirations to do a lot of things, to have a family, to have a job. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with that. God rewards hard work and encourages it. But don't let that be what defines you. Don't let that be, well, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to go here. If you leave God out of it, you're going to lose one day. We have to replace our will with His will, right? We're bought with a price. I think sometimes we think, okay, if we live a pretty good life, we don't drink, we don't do drugs, we don't curse, we're honest. You know, we don't do anything really bad. We keep ourselves pure sexually. We're pretty good people, and really we should be that way. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But sometimes we leave off some of the other things, like obeying our parents and respecting our parents, and bringing our will into compliance with His. You know, God expects all of us, all of you. He expects everything you have. He doesn't expect anything less. And I'm not trying to make it sound harder than it really is. I'm 48 years old, and I face struggles just like I did at 18. Some of them are different now. But you can do it. Jesus is our ultimate example. He went to the cross and died for us because He wanted to do God's will. He was willing to go that far with it, and He did it. Any question that you have? I want to leave you with a thought. That the use of authority and leadership is sanctioned by God. It's ordered by God in nearly every aspect of our life. One thing I thought about when Steve was teaching his lesson a few minutes ago, when he saw that chart. What was the thing on that one chart? We had all those different things, line by line by line. What was on the left side on every one? God. And I like that. I thought that was an impressive point, because if we can get that one right, if we'll do that one completely, serve God completely, comply with His will, we're going to be taking care of the others? I believe so. Jesus clearly respected authority. Don't let anybody fool you into thinking that He didn't, because He absolutely did. And He showed that in His life. We're going to look at different things, different aspects of authority. You're going to go into more detail. I know you'll separate into different classes between young ladies and young men. There'll be very good things to talk about there, to think about. There'll be all the other classes go into more detail about different aspects and different things. Any question that you had about anything? All right, good. We're ending maybe a little bit early, but I don't think you're going to fuss too much, are you? All right. 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. How many of you normally get up by 9 o'clock on Saturday morning? 1, 2, 3, 4. That's pretty good, actually. It's more than I expected. Okay. How many of you got up by 9 this morning? About half of you? Okay. So if you have to get here by 9, plan your morning to get up early enough to get here by 9, if you can. That means you might need to not stay out too late tonight and get a good night's rest. You got a lot of PowerPoints to look at tomorrow, a lot of good stuff, but it is a lot of PowerPoints. You'll want to be fresh. And it'll be great information. All right. Gary back there, if you're looking, needing a place to stay, Gary will take care of you. He'll do anything you need, give you money, whatever. Give you food. He won't do all that. But anyway. Huh? Oh, okay. He's come to our house. Okay. Anyway. Thanks for being here. I am so encouraged by all of you here. And I really do mean that. I think the elders here mean that. I think that as well. It really encourages us. It makes me wish that we had things like this when I was a kid. And no, not just to meet girls, but just to be edified. It's a good thing, and I appreciate it. I believe we're going to have a word of prayer. Mr. Gray is going to lead us in prayer. So let's go to God in prayer, and then we'll be dismissed.